questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. We've left London to head home to Toronto, where a few weeks later, Jonathan joins us to continue his leader's journey. He begins by reflecting on what's emerged for him from these Illumify questions and how he's now feeling about igniting his vision of change. Jonathan, we are now at the juncture of continuing your Illumify Game Changer. Welcome to Toronto, first and foremost.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we're touched that this is your first time in Canada.
Yeah, as I landed yesterday afternoon, it struck me as a bit strange that I had not been here before.
You've been to our neighbour to the south.
Yes, I've been to your neighbour to the south many times, either for business or pleasure, but not Canada. And we're putting that right now.
Yes, we are. So you reached a point in London where you had completed Illuminate, all the 15 questions pertaining to identifying and reaching clarity on what is most meaningful to you, the change most meaningful to you to ignite. And then we continued through the first number of questions related to amplifying that so that it's not just meaningful to you, but also to those who will help you realize it. So can you, given you've had a few weeks to digest and hopefully reflect, tell us where you're sitting on your experience and what is standing out for you, good or bad, at this point?
Mm. I think the vision by the end was very clear. The way I articulated the vision felt very clear.
Which is?
A shared home where we live together in dignity and freedom, in loving respect of our differences, and mindful of our need for each other, not only as citizens and friends and colleagues, but also because it is only through our lives together and our work with each other that we become our true selves.
Beautiful. So in reflecting on that, because that emerged for you, you surfaced that. Did you see more as you reflected? Is it any clearer, more vivid even?
As I reflected, I was curious to go back over the path that we took together to get to the vision. And that was interesting. And there were many points on the path, I think, that will remain important and useful as we go forward. We talked about, we examined together the difference between storytelling and having a vision. Mm-hmm. No rights or wrongs here, but a different idea of what a story is and what it serves and where it comes from. We talked also about the things that would get in the way, what would make a vision difficult, what would be the obstacles. And my very personal response to that was technology, which at one level is about, I think, the natural distance that grows between ourselves and technology as we get older. I think that's a normal phenomenon. I'm nowhere near as fascinated by technology as I was in my 20s, let's say. Certainly much less forgiving of it and what it's done to us, but we talked at length about that. But it's also at the level, the higher level of, I think the real threat that technology today represents if we're not very careful. And we had some good conversations about artificial intelligence and where that might be leading us. And it felt particularly relevant because a lot of our discussions together, and it's starting now to come back to me, so sitting around the table with you again, I can feel it streaming
back. As you shrug your shoulders.
Yeah, okay, sort of getting the shoulders sort of back into shape here. We spent a lot of time talking about words and really trying very hard to find the right word for that moment. And then we digged together, we dug further and tried to understand why that word was particularly apt for that part of the conversation. We looked at etymology, which I thought was a great conversation. The etymology of words is really interesting and helpful. It reminds us sometimes why, where a word comes from and why it's so valuable and why it has its own specific place. Words that have a very specific value, a very specific meaning. And that for me was, that felt very relevant when we talked about artificial intelligence, because there is something about our relationship to language as humans and our search for the right word, whether we're writing a newspaper column or a piece of fiction or a speech or a letter to a loved one, whatever we're writing, that search for the right word, all of this is about language going into the future and creating something new. And I think that was a really good and rich theme that came back again and again through our conversation.
It's so good that, first of all, that you're able to express that you see it so fully, because you know, when you delineate the difference between recreating the past versus creating the new, the future, when you're igniting change, that's new. In this case, you're creating something that doesn't exist. So to rely on artificial intelligence to find the words, knowing that AI can only replicate what already is, pulling threads, piecing together from what already is, not creating the new. So that's both a cautionary tale, but it also speaks to the difference in expressing leadership and the fundamental humanity that's so critical to all of that. So I'm delighted you see that so clearly. Catherine, do you want to add to that?
Marianne, how did you know?
Yeah. I just had a sense.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said around, and we can even have an exclusive 1-month-long conversation about the implications of artificial intelligence. You've brought up so many vital components of the discourse. One of the main, and I would say, proportionately speaking, the largest proportion of the function of artificial intelligence as a phenomenon itself is to be able to consume the information that already exists. And as you stated, text is one of these major forms of data that it eats, so that it can inform its predictive models. It is a machine that predicts what is most likely to be next. And that's a very important perspective to digest when we look at the implications of specifically artificial intelligence. And when we say technology, we certainly don't mean exclusively artificial intelligence. So here we're really focusing in on that. Now, for someone who is willing and aware that they are here to create something new, contribute to a future that doesn't yet exist, and for the betterment of humanity, for the preservation of humanity, for the admiration and celebration of dignity and freedom. Does the idea that artificial intelligence is going to consume your words, put them into its predictive models, and spit out what it deems most appropriate, does that hinder you, stifle you from vocalizing your vision?
That's a great question. That's a great question. And it brings me right back to another theme that ran through all of our discussions, I think, and came back again and again, and in some ways is the best way to answer your question, which is writing. What is the act of writing? What are we doing when we write something new? In the first instance, it's a very personal, intimate conversation with oneself, and necessarily so. When we stare at the empty page and then begin to stumble across the page, filling it with new words, we are writing, at some level, we are writing to ourselves. And I think I mentioned a couple of times, I think it was Toni Morrison who said that it's a love letter or a letter to yourself, mm-hmm, in fiction, which sounds inward-looking, solipsistic. I think it's anything but that. It is simply what is required. There is no other choice. Certainly, when you're writing fiction, you can't write and look at your audience. You're not writing for your audience. That's not what's happening. Even I would say, I would look to you, Marianne, because you know this. I wonder if a speech is any different, really, because ultimately, a speech is very much made for a particular audience at a particular moment in time.
It should be. It's not always, but it should be.
And yet, even there, I would say that the first task, if it's going to be a speech that works, I think the first question is it true to the person who's going to
speak? Oh, of course. Of course, that's a starting point. You know, yeah.
It's got to be true.
Yeah.
To the beliefs and the values of that person, but also the language and the choice of words of that person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, authentic to that person.
So coming back to your question, Catherine, I think there is something here about, as we articulate a vision and we try and find the words for that, the first phase, the first piece of work is necessarily private, intimate, perhaps inward-looking, as we search for the right words. And we have to get that right and feel that it's true before we go out into the world in any way.
But there's no concern that it could be used in different ways once it's out there.
I think that with any creative act, once you've let go of it, it ceases to belong to you. It's simply out there, and people will do what they want with it. There's nothing much we can do about that. That's fine.
But what if, because this is different than a creative act, you're igniting change. So what if what you're saying becomes so refracted by other people that no one can hear you?
Or assumption gets infused into their experience of listening, and they're not actually hearing you, they're hearing what they assume you're saying.
Mm-hmm. A speech, for example, where if you're on a campaign trail, you would make versions, iterations, variations of a speech as you went on the campaign, coming back to similar themes, the same themes, but freshening up your language for different audiences, different parts of the country, let's say. And what's happening there is you are starting to you're drawing me to the word amplify, aren't you? I can feel it. I'm not
Isn't
looking
that
at
obvious?
You. I'm looking out the window. I'm not looking at you. I'm stubbornly looking out the window.
You are in amplify.
I was going to use the word hammer home, but that feels a bit brittle and brutal.
Well, in a world of such noise and chaos, isn't it essential at some point?
There is something about repetition, the goodness of repetition. So repetition, but I think we're also making the transition here from words on the page, whether that's for a novel or a speech or a newspaper article, an opinion piece, an op-ed. I think we're starting to talk, we're making the transition now from the words on the page to the human being who is embodying the message, the vision. And I'm reminded now that we talked, again, a great theme. So much of our conversation was about the love of language, but we also recognized, I think, at important moments in our conversation, the limits of language. Mm-hmm. And that at some point, you just have to get out there into the world physically.
Yeah.
To defend your position, to promote your position, to get among the people. We had a lovely conversation about leaders standing up there in front of the crowd. And I talked about the artists I've loved where I've stood beneath them and looked up at them and just had found such pleasure, deep, deep pleasure, in looking up to them and worshipping them. But we also talked about leaders who walked with their crowd. And this is perhaps most obviously political leaders. And we talked about Gandhi and Martin Luther King, where my mental picture is, it's not of them behind a microphone, but walking with their people.
That march across the bridge, for example.
Exactly. Yeah absolutely. And that's where, that's because language is not enough. It has its limits, and political action and a political vision at some point needs to be embodied by the people.
So leadership emerges through language. The words that you use to capture your vision and make those powerful declarations are critical to it. But leadership, your leadership, is made credible by the actions. And yet when you think, we spoke briefly of speech acts, didn't we? When you think, the very term, speech acts, it is the actions are conveyed through words as well. They begin with the words. So I often say to clients, when they say to me, oh, well, I did it, why don't they see it? Or why don't they know I did it? Well, first of all, unless they're standing right beside you or in front of you, they don't know that you did it. But unless, even if they're with you and you do something, you take an action, the interpretation of that action could be completely misconstrued unless they understand the context in which that action is made. So it's not enough to, quote, just speak, to give the words, because then it's just talk. And trust ultimately will erode. And sadly, we have a lot of examples of that in political leadership right now. Make fast promises and declarations, and none of it is ever fulfilled. And it's not enough just to act, because again, those actions, well, first of all, they're your actions. And it takes a collective to act to ignite a significant, meaningful change. There's a magnitude of action required, right? So it is both the words and the actions which are themselves imparted through words.
And Jonathan, you brought up such a powerful tool in referencing repetition, a repetition specifically in the name of representation, that which you embody to repeat over and over in the integrity of the original form of the vision. Yes, altering it, reframing it, depending on the audience there in the name of connection. Artificial intelligence in itself, yes, duplicates over and over again. It also is based on a predictive model where the human will get bored and become...
Same old.
Yes, frustrated and will feel it's tedious to continue repeating. And so it will leverage that to mutate as it goes, to change and warp the original. So repetition in the name of representation is very, very powerful there.
Well, representation, well said, Catherine. Representation implies or creates even consistency and congruency, mm-hmm. which is important. If we hear 100 different versions of something all at once, it may be an idea, it may be in an organization that has 50 different spokespeople expressing that idea, and they all express it differently. Well, the recipients of that, the quote, listeners, the audience, is going to hear 50 different interpretations and think, well, what is it? Is it this? Is it that? I don't know. I'm not certain. So how can I act when I don't know? So repetition gives the consistency and the congruency. However, you also have to calibrate, just as you alluded to, Catherine, again, back to the tremendous distinction between AI and repetition and the human ability to discern. When you first say something, so say it once to a group of people, you can't assume that when you speak to them again, they are in the same place, the same level of understanding, awareness, the same concerns, the same interests. So an AI would just replicate. Let's go back in. We met with them before. Let's do it again. Same thing. So the ability to calibrate and to take threads that are now common, to move them along that spectrum of change. In your Illuminate experience, it was about going inside, internally. And that is so true, because in surfacing your truth, you need to do that. And the process of Illuminate is to emerge with a knowingness, a level of knowingness that is unshakable. And it's bespoke to you. It also can, doesn't always, but it can be absolutely aligned, even a reflection of your raison d'être, your reason for being here. So if that is truth, and if we reach a stage in our lives where we have been on different paths, meaningful paths, perhaps professionally and personally, etc., we have a choice of continuing along those paths to the end of our lives, or we have an opportunity through Illuminate to verify for oneself that the path that you're on is the one most meant for you. It's the one you set out to be on. And that's why Illuminate, those are big questions that in different ways help you surface it. You clear some of what may be existing beliefs clouding what that is. It's a little bit like mining, I would think, and it's a little like polishing a diamond, getting to the clarity of what that is. First and foremost for yourself, it is very much illuminating for yourself. And in so doing, you're illuminating your initiative, that meaningful change that matters to you. And you're also illuminating parts of yourself you may not have seen. And certainly your leadership. There's a lot that happens in Illuminate. And it's not... I don't think it's a painful process. Do you? Maybe you do at parts. Was it painful?
Not painful, but simply very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that?
Sure.
And no, Jonathan, that as you're saying this, I am reevaluating my decision as to whether or not to do it myself.
Oh, you don't get off that lightly.
I'm listening to every word.
It's inevitable that the hardest parts are where you're coming up against obstacles within yourself, things in your own heart and mind that you've not resolved yourself, where the conversation is surfacing obstacles within you, walls within you, regret as well. Sometimes we talked a little bit about regret. That's where it's hard.
You came in by virtue of some correspondence we had. You came into the Illumify Game Changer saying to us, I'm not a leader right now. Do you feel differently?
Something changed during our first week together in London, the first part of our conversation. And I briefly mentioned this at the time, I think towards the end, it came up naturally in one of our conversations. But I was starting to feel some energy and confidence returning just through the conversations we were having. And this revolved around, I think the first time I voiced this was when I was talking about mantras, these little snippets of text, little or small voices that would come into my head as I walked my dog around Copenhagen. And one of the most recent mantras was, I have something to say.
Can you say that again, Jonathan?
I have something to say.
And one more time.
I have something to say.
Thank you.
Now, that mantra popped into my head a few weeks before we met for the first time in London.
A coincidence, do you think?
Well, I think I held on to it when we were having the Illuminate part of the conversation, that first series of conversations in London. I was holding on to that as this. There is something here that is pushing me forward and helping me to prepare for next year and whatever comes next year. I mean, it's a very human thing to do. As we reach the end of 1 year, we start to look to the next. It's completely arbitrary. This is because, well, I say arbitrary. I was going to talk about the calendar, but it's the seasons as well. It's not entirely arbitrary. We are in tune with the world around us as well. The calendar, the months are arbitrary. But I think if we look at the world outside, it's not so arbitrary. It makes sense. So I felt the return of energy and confidence through our conversation, definitely. I would also say that when I went back to Copenhagen after those conversations, and this is a month ago almost, when I was back in Copenhagen and again starting to think perhaps in more practical terms about what comes next in my life, all of our conversations were swirling around inside me and I was reflecting on them. And in ways which are difficult to quantify or articulate, I do feel that I was starting to see next year differently. And I don't want to go into the details of this now. It doesn't feels too specific. It may come out later. Fine.
It likely will.
I won't reveal it now. But certainly in one or two areas, I could feel very naturally. This was coming up. Yeah, very naturally. In my own mind, also in conversations with my my partner Liz, what was coming up to the surface was a desire to come back onto the field of play. And perhaps in one particular example, take on a position of leadership and be visible, try and make something happen. So this is beyond language. This would be actually stepping up. Mm-hmm. And the beginnings of a vision of how that would look within a particular context, a particular mm-hmm. organization. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think I would have got there without the conversation we had been having. I'm as certain as I can be that that new sense of energy mm-hmm. and confidence, but also a desire to step up and make something happen.
Good.
I'm as sure as I can be that that had been triggered by the conversations we were having, I think, yeah.
And all the heavy lifting you did. Bravo. Bravo, really. Because what happens then, we always have a choice, Jonathan, we always have a choice to act or not to act. There are consequences to each, but we always have a choice. But when you see what is most significant to you that does not yet exist, you can turn away and hope someone else realizes it, creates it, does it. Or you can take part, big part, leadership part, or not. It's always a choice. For me, once you see, you cannot unsee. That's been my experience. And then everything becomes about being in alignment with that, because being misaligned, even slightly, comes at a terrible cost internally, if not externally. But again, it's always a choice. Leadership, we've talked about this, is not for the faint of heart. You know, those forces are going to push back. But when you see, you don't have to see how yet. So I hope you're not focusing on that. We will get there. Don't worry. The first step is to see the, quote, destination that you're aiming for. And that's where, back to consistency, that's so important that you keep your eye there, because everything between now and then, there's going to be a magnitude of resistance, both external and maybe internal, but also a clouding that far off on the horizon is distant, yeah? So the more vivid you can keep it in your sight, the better. And then this may be a time to contrast the difference between vision and big picture. As you strive to realize that vision, it's incremental, yeah? You can take maybe little moments of change that amount up to the bigger, or quantum leaps. Whatever it is, as you advance, move, progress, around you is going to look different. The vision is the same, but the big picture will keep changing. Obstacles will be removed, new ones will emerge. And so your ability to keep your eye on that vision is so central to that. My next question for you then, with respect to leadership, and I am absolutely delighted. One of my Achilles is I see potential in people, but they have to be able to choose to realize that I saw your leadership potential. So delighted. Thank you. I'm doing my happy dance. That's it. Again, not for the faint of heart. Do you feel any level, any degree of resistance at this point in time?
Within myself? Yes, I do. Where the resistance exists, I'm tempted to say it's for a good reason. Some of it may be fear, And I might be blocking out the fear with what I'm going to say now. So the positive good reasons that I'm going to say now may be a way of avoiding the fear or blocking it out. And at this point, necessarily, I'll have to be a bit more concrete. I was just going to say, but let me just say this before I forget, because it's an important parenthesis, I think. There was something very difficult. There was a balancing act, which was very difficult in our first conversation, in the Illuminate part of this. But I think organically through our conversation, I mean, this is not written down in the rules of the Illumify game here. I think we arrive there naturally through our conversation. That there was a constant back and forth between the conceptual and where we were trying to find the right words to describe vision, what a vision is, where it comes from, what are the obstacles to it within ourselves and out there in the world. A back and forth between that and then my own personal world, so the world that I live in. And that world was a world where we talked a lot about the European Union and what that means to me, Ukraine and what Ukraine means to me at the moment, and how the future of the European Union is utterly tied up with the fate of Ukraine. And I went beyond that and I said, I think there's even more at stake than the future of the European Union. And I still believe that. And we naturally went back and forth between that very real set of political, geopolitical issues of today, and then on the other side, the conceptual, our search for a vision. And that back and forth, I think, was a very good exercise. It was very difficult. And I think you, Marianne, rightly pulled me back at times from something that was getting too bogged down in the today, in the mechanics of today, and brought me back to the vision. You were talking, Catherine, a few moments ago, you were talking about how our conversation here, the three of us, has been constantly reforming.
Yes.
And rewriting our own scripts here, the stories we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
Just gently breaking things up so that we rewrite them in the next conversation. And I'm sure that even now, we're not merely copying what we said a month ago.
Yes.
Back in London, but there'll be a new colour, a bit of nuance to what we're saying now, which is slightly different. And I think that's really important and healthy. And it brings us back to this tension between the vision and what it is rooted in, and the need for that. There's a healthy tension between the two. The need to be rooted in something that brings stability, knowledge, confidence, some degree of certainty, some degree of intolerance that we have refused, if we're talking about values. We have excluded these values because we felt them to be wrong. We are excluding these values because they led us down the wrong path. You were talking earlier, Marianne, about expediency and speed and convenience. I think that's a great example of a value that has led us down the wrong path. If I look at the last 20, 30 years, the idea that if we can do something more quickly, more easily, and preferably from the screen of my phone, that is a good thing. Whatever it is, that's just good. So this is a value where we have elevated to the status of value, speed, efficiency, convenience. If I have to spend less time on this, if it's easier for me, it is good. Yeah. It doesn't matter what it is, this is good.
And that's of primary value.
Yes, yes.
Which is really where assumptions come in, isn't it? You don't do the due diligence because it's not in the name of expediency.
Exactly, because we value expediency above all.
Right. If we can do it more quickly, with less pain, less effort, and ideally, you know, from my screen, at my fingertips, then that is good. Whatever it is, that's good.
Because
that's
we're what able life's to about. Achieve more. We're more productive.
Right.
We're busy and we're right. more productive.
Right. So I think that's a great example of a modern value which has emerged.
Which technology and, yes, drives. Yeah.
Yeah. And grips us. Well, the technology, yes, but this is what the human, we have to celebrate it as humans for it to become a value.
Yes.
That's where
yes, that's
where
right.
it becomes a powerful idea that shapes our lives and how we live. I have no idea how we got here, but it felt like a useful part of our conversation. Yeah.
Can I just ask, Marianne, when you hear about the speeding up of the consumption of stimulus, I don't know how else to, how do you feel that the pause is affected by this? Here's the reason I'm asking. In your diagnostic, the pause is something that you assess. Mm-hmm. It, I'm assuming, being a powerful form of communication when used optimally, let's say, or leveraged in the way that it can. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it will diminish in value or become unrecognizable, incomprehensible, undigestible by the expedited populace?
Expedited populace. It's interesting. In my diagnostic, there are 150 different metrics, all of which are essential to expressing leadership. And pause is in there because the research showed 20 years ago when I first created this, it's, you know, those Greeks, those ancient Greeks, man, they knew about rhetoric. Think of Cicero, for example. So the ancient Greeks realized the value of a pause. And what is a pause? A pause can last when you're speaking. There's no pause in writing, although you could do dot, 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 new paragraph. You could argue that's a form of a pause, yeah? But in speaking, it's when we stop speaking. And when we do that, so first of all, when we are speaking, let's think of the listener. Our words are invisible to the listener. We mouth them, we transmit them, but the listener doesn't see them, unlike reading an article or newspaper or whatever screen. The listener can't go back and reread a sentence or a paragraph. The listener does not know what is most significant in all of the words unless we help them interpret our words. And we do that with our pace and our tone, of course, but we also do it with a pause. So what a pause does, and it can be 2 seconds, 1001, 1002, just that short. Or it can be an elongated pause where you're standing in or sitting in front of a group of people, you've said something, and you stop and you look around the room. If there are hundreds of people in front of you, if you're on a stage at a podium, you can break that audience into quarters or into thirds, and you find someone in each quarter or each third, you pan the room. And then it makes it feel to each and every one of them that you're speaking directly to them. You see them. But here's the thing with the pause, because you can do that even when you're not pausing and should. With the pause, you are signaling to them that you've said something significant and you're giving them permission, space, opportunity to absorb what you've said. When we hear silence, it's even if we've tuned out, which we are doing more and more as a, what was your term of the populace?
Expedited, is it?
Yeah, something like that. We tune out. Like we look like we're here. We look like we're listening, but we're really not. And then suddenly we hear silence in the midst of a meeting or a speech or broadcast. And it alerts us that something's changed. So we tune back in. So it gives us an opportunity to absorb, to integrate. Also, when we transmit words as a speaker, depending on the setting, your words literally have to bounce off the walls for them to capture them. Nanoseconds, of course, but still, I mean, this goes with pace of speech. If you speak so quickly, you're throwing a volley of words at them and expecting them to do the heavy lifting of interpreting them. So a pause as a leader, the reason it's in my diagnostic is that it gives a leader the opportunity to signal, listen to this especially. I've just been speaking to you for 20 minutes, half an hour. That's a lot of verbiage. Listen to this especially. It's like a stop sign, an underline, and a space in which they can absorb and integrate what you've said.
So maybe it'll stay around?
I think it's more critical than ever. But you have to be aware of it and use it, certainly as a leader, so for the benefit of all.
Sorry to interrupt. Yes. Would you include a disclaimer at the start of this podcast or at the start of every episode that advises listeners not to listen to it at a faster pace?
Well, it's funny we'd even have to do that. Listen, I can be guilty of listening to some things at a faster pace, but usually because I know what's in the communication. I was present in that communication. Do I want to give that as a announce that as a cautionary note or a disclaimer or whatever? I believe anyone listening to this, and I hope there is someone listening to this, will have come to a quick realization, as Jonathan did, and we say that from the perspective of a professional writer, that words really matter. And in Jonathan's case, his ability to articulate himself throughout this, he's a master. So do you want fast food or do you want
gourmet,
to enjoy the gourmet feast, yes, of the language that's being used in these conversations?
Nice.
The only thing I would add to this is that this is not so much about our political values. We're closer here to visions of the good life and what the good life is and how to live a good life. And to be absolutely clear, in the sort of world that I want to live in, we all find our own path. We all find our own path. But there is something here about attention and the quality of our attention. And one of the few certainties I have at this stage in my life, where I feel very confident about something, not because I have found the key to something or found the answer to something, but just something that just seems to be very true, and where you reach this knowledge through your own experience and through conversations with other people, which is that some very important things take time. They just do. And if we try and skirt around them, if we try and accelerate them, we lose something. We lose something. And when I have talked to friends or family members, relatives, about the deep pleasures of reading or going to the cinema, it's because you want to share that deep pleasure. You want others to have access to it as well. And so much of the quality of our day-to-day life and our sense of well-being is tied up with how we devote our attention. Mm-hmm. Our attention is limited. Our attention is limited. We are naturally distracted. We naturally become tired as the day goes on, as the year goes on. And so the question of where and how we direct our attention is absolutely critical to the quality of our life, second by second. And what distresses me, and it does distress me, when I look at our modern elevation of, it's not that we have only, we have elevated speed and expediency and convenience mm-hmm. to something that is intrinsically good. This is a good thing. Doesn't matter what we're doing. If we can do it more quickly, more easily, more conveniently, that is good. Okay.
Yeah, that's optimal.
But it's tied. It becomes tied. You can't avoid going. Those choices and the elevation of that, those choices to the status of a value, it brings damage. And I see people around me who have normalized. A lot of this is about normalization.
It is, yeah.
Our addiction to the screen, let me just, and again, got my big snob t-shirt on here. but I'm saying this because I care. I fear that we're sort of shrugging our shoulders and normalizing, hey, shucks, you know, we're all addicted to the screen. As if we'd never had any choice. As if we've been addicted to screens for the last 100 years. A lot of our present day culture of expediency and lack of attention has come very, very, very recently. It's come very, very, very recently. And I'm saying that only because we do have choices to make, and we can wake up and recognize the bad choices that we've made, and we can stop values from becoming too hard set, and we can reject them. That's mm-hmm. that's why I'm saying this.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we leave resistance, I want to go back to your answer to card 15 in Illuminate about courage. And do you have the courage to ignite your meaningful change? And in my notes, your words were now or never. And that courage comes in moments of darkness, that we recycle it to use it for moments of light. Do you recall saying that?
I don't remember those, the final words about darkness and light there. But certainly, I remember talking a lot about crisis and crisis that was necessary. I'm deeply attached to this idea that each human being necessarily approaches crisis. I'm still not decided whether we each have one big defining crisis in our lives or a series. Maybe a daily crisis. I don't know. But there is a real connection here between crisis and courage, and I think the need for change. And I think the thing wrapping all of this together is truth, because this a truth again was a word and a theme that came back again and again in so many of our conversations illuminating the necessary change. And what is, I was just talking there about the good life. What is the good life for me? The good life for me, or an important thread of the good life, is to dig down and get to the truth about yourself and accept it. That requires courage. Coming back to the chasm here, it's, you know, how do we build this bridge between one person, whoever it is, in this case, me, and a vision of politics and the political community. And I think this is where I'm, you know, in this big sea, I'm holding on to a life raft here, or a life vest, desperately hanging on to the idea that for a political vision to be true, whatever it is, but it has to, at some level, it has to be in harmony with our inner life. I remember we slowly built this bridge over the course of our first conversations. We talked a lot about our fractured selves, our fragmented selves. Our world feels very fragmented at the moment. We appear to live in an age of fragmentation, where our, just the way we experience the world, the way we experience the world day to day, feels fragmented. But I've always felt that we are fragmented inside ourselves from birth. So we are born broken. We are born fragmented. And part of the idea of the good life is that through life, as we go through it together with family, friends, colleagues, neighbours, fellow citizens, that through our work together, through our love of each other, our love and our friendships, our marriages, but also our working relationships in the office, on the factory floor, whatever we're doing, that we mend ourselves through the work that we do together. And the reason I'm saying this now is because that helps me. It gives me something to cling on to, that this isn't an airy, elevated, conceptual vision of some ideal future, but is deeply rooted, again, in the body. It comes back to the body. I've scribbled down here that we, dignity, our dignity begins in the body, the child, the sacred value of each child, wherever she is born. This is where there is a human reality which underpins the truth, which underpins the idea. And then over time, we write about this idea, and over centuries, it becomes an idea. So the idea of dignity. And dignity becomes the foundation on which we build human rights. And now we're very much in the world of the words, the constitution, the speech, the political manifesto. But then it has to go back to the body as the leader marches with his people, or the protester who marches into the city and defies the leaders because they are corrupt. So we're back to the body. Language has reached its limits, and we have to march. We have to march and bring down a power that is wrong and corrupt, or we have to stand up and march and proclaim our manifesto. So we're back to the body. So from the body to the idea, and then back to the body again, so that it is embodied. And the only reason I'm saying this again is just to help myself deal with this chasm between me and this crazily big idea of the vision.
You know, so many people assume that there has to be a bridge over this chasm. What if the way to cross it is fill it with repetition?
That's a nice image. That's also paving your way across it, or filling it with it. Yeah, with ground. Yeah. I like that.
Maybe that's the new ground.
Yeah, the new ground keeps emerging.
Yeah.
Similar to when you think of Copenhagen and how much they've done to expand the city.
Yes.
With infill, literally putting in new ground on which to remove the encroachment of the sea, create terra firma, build on terra firma. So if that new ground doesn't exist yet, Jonathan, and there's a chasm between you and what you see, can it be filled with new ground? And what does that new ground represent? And you don't have to know that yet.
No. No. But what strikes me there is that you, again, it comes back to that first moment of creation, the first moment of writing, where whatever you're writing about, whether it's a new cheese or a new constitution, mm-hmm. you are describing something that's very close to you and private, and that you can get your hands around. It's your words, your language. So even if you are writing about something big and visionary and that necessarily would involve lots of other people, I think you have to take some comfort in the proximity of language and your truth and your words. Otherwise it would be intolerable, mm-hmm. wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
It would be too much.
Absolutely.
It would be too much.
And that is why this entire experience, the Illumify Game Changer, begins with you illuminating what it is that is most meaningful to you to ignite. And now, as a maybe an appropriate segue, you're in amplifying it. So it's also meaningful to those who can help you ignite it. So it's not just resting on your shoulders. This is where we go from I to we. Mm-hmm. By being able to express it in a way that it becomes equally significant, equally meaningful to others who cannot yet either see it for themselves, or maybe they've seen a glimpse of it and they've dismissed it as impossible. And you come along with this compelling vision that speaks to them about what truly could be. That's where we're at in amplifying. Good to go?
Bring it on.
Great. Jonathan has come a long way since he began his leader's journey in London. He's feeling more confident and a little more comfortable with being the leader that ignites his vision of meaningful change. He sees even more clearly that his vision is founded on those values that embody truth. Given that the world is now largely governed by values like expediency, part of breaking with the past is going to necessitate discarding those values that no longer serve. He realizes that there is a big chasm between his vision of what could be and what actually is today. But he sees there's a way to fill it. Step by step, he goes on his leader's journey. Stay tuned. If listening to this Illumify Game Changer podcast is of value to you, please like it on this platform and share it with those who could ignite meaningful change. It's here, as am I, to be of service. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the Leader's Journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.